Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. For about $3 a year, you and I and all Americans pay for and benefit from the most sophisticated fleet of weather observation satellites in the world. Well, I guess technically they're out of this world, but you get the picture. You get the picture on a daily basis when you watch TV weather forecasts that show you everything from incoming storms to smoke and heat plumes from wildfires. In November of 2017, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration launched JPSS-1, or Joint Polar Satellite System, which was rechristened NOAA-20 once in orbit. I knew there were two basic types of weather satellites, those in geostationary orbits that stay in one position over the Earth, and the polar orbiting satellites that scan the entire planet. That got me interested in what roles each type plays in our weather forecasts, so I got in touch with NOAA and arranged to talk to two of their experts. Later on in the show, we'll listen to a conversation with Joe Pica. He's the Director of Observations for the National Weather Service from NOAA, and Rob Elvington, a television meteorologist who has some serious scientific chops. But first, let's visit with Mitch Goldberg. Mitch is the Chief Program Scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System and an expert on all things having to do with our constellation of weather observation satellites. He joined us from the headquarters of JPSS in Greenbelt, Maryland via Skype. Mitch Goldberg, welcome to Blue Dot. I'd like you to begin, Mitch, by talking about the fleet, the constellation of satellites that NOAA uses to help us forecast and track the weather. I know, for example, that when we watch the local weather forecast, we see images from one type of satellite, and you're going to tell us about the other kind, the polar orbiting satellites. But first, give us an overview of what we have in orbit and how we use them.
So we have a constellation of satellites in low Earth orbit and geostationary orbit. We have our own satellites for both orbits, and we also use satellites from other agencies, including those from Europe and Japan, as well as meteorological satellites from the Department of Defense, which we actually operate. So low Earth orbits, they're primarily pole orbiting satellites, and they basically orbit from the pole to pole at an altitude of about 512 miles, and as it's orbiting, the Earth is rotating underneath it. And this is how we get global observations, which are critical for forecasting weather out to 7 days. So you can have a big event, like let's say a typhoon off of Japan, that will unleash plumes of moisture and heavy precipitation that can impact the west coast of the United States like 5 days later. So that's why global observations are important for forecasting. And then in addition to polar orbiting satellites, we have the geostationary satellite, which you see on TV every single day on the forecast, weather forecast. And they basically orbit the Earth over the equator at about 22,300 miles. That's a key altitude. So that the satellite is moving at the same speed as the Earth is moving. So our part of the Earth is always in view, and the geostationary satellites are monitoring weather in real time as it unfolds.
Yes, so they have orbital periods that are the same as the rotation of the Earth, which is why, listener out there, if you ever wondered why your satellite TV dish never moves, that's the reason. The geostationary satellites have an orbital period of 24 hours, so they're literally parked over the same spot on Earth as they orbit it. And that was thought up by the famous science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, I believe back in the 1940s.
Yeah, so we always say that polar satellites, they basically provide the data needed to prepare for severe weather events days in advance. And we saw how important that was for last year's big hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, and Maria. And while the geostationary satellite is providing the critical information while the severe event is taking place in real time.
Tell us about JPSS. Is this a pair of orbiting satellites, and is this a new system?
Well, JPSS is the first of a new generation. So we've been flying polar satellites since the 1960s. So every now and then there's a new generation, and the new generation will be around for the next 20 years. And so it's a very advanced weather satellite system. JPSS-1 was launched in November 18th, 2017, just a few months ago. Once it reached an orbit, it became NOAA-20. And then we'll have three more missions, JPSS 2 through 4, and will provide us with uninterrupted coverage for the next 20 years.
Wow. Can you give us, you mentioned that this is the next generation. Can you give us a brief history of weather satellites?
Yeah, so with respect to polar orbiting satellites, the very first satellite was a polar orbiting satellite, and it was called TIROS, and that goes back to 1960 and continued into the 60s. Like, I think it ended like 67 or 68, and it basically provided us with the very first fuzzy pictures of the Earth, basically showing where the clouds are. And also, these satellites would only last for, it would only work for a short amount of time, so we were launching satellites quite a bit, maybe 2-3 times a year. They would break quite frequently. But these fuzzy pictures were really important for the time because it was the first time meteorologists could see storm features from space. Finally, you could see what a hurricane looked like, the entire hurricane being imaged, or a line of thunderstorms. And then from there, we kept on making improvements. So the second generation was from the late 60s to the early 70s, and we had improved imagery, better spatial resolution. The third generation covered the 70s, and for the first time, we had instruments that could actually measure atmospheric temperature, which is critical for weather forecasting. So when you look at a picture of a storm, that doesn't really give you the information of how, for weather forecasting. You know, we're also trying to predict weather instead of just watching weather, right? And then during the 1960s and 70s, NASA had a series of research satellites with more advanced capabilities that were introduced to NOAA operational weather satellites, which really became like the fourth generation. So there's been many, many generations. Each time there's a new generation, we get more advanced capabilities. So during the fourth generation, which covered the 80s and the 90s, we were, for the very first time, we could observe the atmospheric temperature, water vapor, of course, clouds, ozone. We were able to observe sea ice, sea and land surface temperature, vegetation, the health of vegetation, volcanic ash and fires. The fifth generation is basically the same as the fourth, but included a much better atmospheric sounder that could see atmospheric temperature and water vapor through cloudy conditions. And that was a critical step because for the first time, satellites started to have huge impacts in the weather forecast and the confidence weather forecasting. And that was around the late 1990s. And then during the 2000s, we had the first time NASA research missions and European missions, which even provided more advanced capabilities for atmospheric temperature and water vapor, which then are, and these advancements are now all on JPSS. So JPSS is a culmination of all the advancements over the past 10, 20 years being in part of our operational program today.
Well, let's talk about JPSS specifically. What role does NASA play in this? You're from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but does NASA play a role too?
Absolutely. So JPSS is really a joint NOAA-NASA program. It's a NOAA satellite program, but NASA is our major acquisition office. So they basically acquire the instruments, the satellite, they launch the satellite, and then we, at NOAA, we operate the satellite, and then we generate the different products from the satellites. So NASA plays a critical role in acquiring the instruments for us.
Let's talk about the instruments you have on JPSS, because it isn't just a camera you have up there. Tell us about the suite of instruments that are on board the satellite and what they're used for.
Okay, sure. So I talked already about the early generation, the first showing fuzzy pictures of clouds, not really doing much, but still very important because it allowed meteorologists to see what these storms look like. And then over the course of time, we made major advancements. So today with JPSS, we sort of have those advancements. So the first instrument, well, it's a lineup of instruments. It's like having a baseball team, a lineup of players. So the first instrument in our lineup is called the Advanced Technology Microwave Sounder. It's a microwave sounder that can see through clouds, which is very important, and it provides us with atmospheric temperature and water vapor through all weather conditions, nearly all weather conditions, but it also provides us with global mapping of precipitation, snow and ice cover. And that's a critical input to weather forecasting. Then we have something called the CRIS. It's the cross-track infrared sounder. It provides us with more accurate detailed information about temperature and moisture. So it provides us with higher fidelity, which means that if you look, if you go through the atmosphere as a function of height, you know, the atmospheric temperature and water vapor changes quickly as you know, it can change quickly as a function of height. And so CRIS, because it's in the infrared and it's more sensitive to energy, we can actually see more layers of the atmosphere. We have higher fidelity in terms of atmospheric structure. And the CRIS has 6 times the vertical resolution, which means I can see 6 times more information than our older generation satellite. And so the CRIS instrument is also a critical instrument for weather forecasting. So together, ATMS and CRIS, the sounders, is what provides the critical data into weather forecast models. The next instrument is called VIRS, which is our imager. It has very high spatial resolution, lots of different bands. It's used for weather forecasting, but also mostly for environmental assessments. Like we can observe and measure sea surface temperature, which is critical for weather forecast models. We can look at ocean and coastal water quality, oil spills. We monitor sea ice, floods, fires, smoke, volcanic eruptions, droughts, all on a global scale. And that's really, really important. And later I can talk about different applications. Then we also have ozone, OMPS, which is called the Ozone Mapping Profile Suite. And that helps us track the health of the ozone layer and measure the concentration of ozone in the atmosphere. So it's very important for tracking dangerous UV radiation that can increase our risk of cancer. You know, OMPS data goes into the UV forecast, which we all know about. It also very important, helps monitor the size of the Arctic ozone hole. And it also is used for other applications like air quality, and also can detect volcanic eruptions, SO2 plumes, for example, from volcanoes. And then we have finally the last instrument on the team is called Ceres. It's a cloud and Earth's radiant energy system, and it measures reflected sunlight and thermal radiation. It's very important for energy budget studies, and it's also used for improving climate models. So we have a number of instruments, and all of them are important for better understanding, describing our environment, our atmosphere, our Earth, terrestrial, oceanic, and atmospheric parameters that are used for so many different applications.
Wow, so it's a lot more than what I think of as a weather satellite. Can you talk a bit more about the unique capabilities it has to observe phenomena like wildfires and volcanic eruptions, both of which have been very much in the news recently?
Sure. So our sensor, so VIRS, for example, has very good spatial resolution. It has, basically, you can see 375 meters, which is about 1,200 feet, you know, side by side, like a box that's that large. Or that small. It all depends on your perspective. However, it's very sensitive to the information within the box. So, for example, you can have a fire that's, a blazing fire that's only 9 feet by 9 feet, and you can see it from the satellite. So VIRS is very important for detecting small fires before they potentially can become large. And so we provide that information to the U.S. Fire Service, for example. And it also is used in models for forecasting smoke. So when you have a fire, of course, you have the fire, the spread of the fire, but we can also measure the heat of the fire, the temperature of the fire. That's important for smoke forecast, because if the fire is more intense, the plumes of smoke will rise higher in the atmosphere, and it will spread further from the source, which of course can impact air quality.
You're listening to Blue Dot from NSPR. I'm Dave Shlom. When we return from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Mitch Goldberg, Chief Program Scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back, and thank you for listening. Let's get back to our interview with NOAA Chief Program Scientist Mitch Goldberg as we talk weather satellites. And of course, these satellites are paid for by our tax dollars. Personally, I can't think of something like that that really impacts our lives as we plan our daily activities in terms of the weather. Could you talk about the value to the public of these satellites for all of us Americans?
In terms of the instrumentation, like the sounder data, the microwave and infrared sounder that goes into the weather forecast models, and 85% of the data that goes into weather forecast models come from satellites, polar satellites like JPSS that has these type of instruments. So imagine the value alone of the forecast. The forecast basically impacts every segment of our population or every component of our economy. And so just planning for events like even construction and tourism, navigation, recreation, transportation, and so forth. The forecast has huge impacts on those activities. So it's has a large impact on the economy. And in terms of immediate impacts like lives and property, again, being able to see where we have wildfires is very important. It provides data about air quality that can immediately impact people with respiratory problems. It can look at vegetation, the health of vegetation, which of course impacts agriculture and food security. So the economic impact and the societal impact of our weather satellites is significant. It's very, very large. Without our weather satellites, the 7-day forecast that you have today, you wouldn't be able to predict it with the reliability that we have today, or the 5-day forecast. Maybe if you're lucky, you would get an accurate 3-day forecast. But satellites really extend the forecast out to 7 days, and because of that, we can plan for extreme weather events and also for good weather events.
Yes, and people make fun of weather forecasts, saying things like, they always get the forecast wrong. But that's not true. Forecasts are incredibly accurate, aren't they?
Absolutely. So if you look at the charts, when I was a kid, like in the 1960s, I would hope for a snowstorm so I didn't have to take my test the next day, right? And I sometimes would wake up and go, wow, there's a lot of snow, because sometimes you couldn't predict these storms very well. But today we predict weather events so well because of the advancements in satellite data, the advancement in weather forecast models, everything came together. There's a combination of information needed to make a good weather forecast. It's the data that goes into the forecast model. So satellite data, of course, is the critical component. Then, of course, it's the modeling, the model physics, and the computer power, and also, of course, smart people, coming up with these models. And so it all came together in the 2000s. In the early 2000s, it all came together. And today, we're very fortunate to have very good weather forecasts. And JPSS basically provides continuity of the key observations that we'll need for the next 20 years and beyond.
I'm curious to find out about how someone like you, who is a program scientist for something as important as this, the polar orbiting satellites that are crucial to weather forecasting, how did you first get interested in science in general and weather in particular? Was it as a child?
Sure. Thinking about it, I always loved the weather. And I would watch all the weather TV meteorologist forecasters on the New York local channels. I grew up in New Jersey, and I remember always being up for a snowstorm. I would watch the snowfall during the night, because I had a street light outside my window. So I just would watch the snowfall, and I would, listen to the weather forecast all the time. So I always liked snow and weather. So I went to Rutgers in the late 1970s for my bachelor's in meteorology. And of course, meteorology itself is very broad. It's not just weather forecasts. It includes atmospheric physics, instrumentation, So later on in my sophomore year, I heard about this intern program in NOAA for weather satellites. So I applied and I got in and I became fascinated with satellites and I really never looked back. I continued my education. I received my PhD from University of Maryland, and I've really been associated or worked with NOAA since 1978. So I started as an intern. I went back to University of Maryland. I was a NOAA contractor, and I became a NOAA government scientist, I think, in 1990. And I've been working in the field ever since. And basically, when I started, I was starting on the two generations of satellites earlier than we have today. And now I'm fortunate towards the end of my career, I still have at least 10, 15 years left in me in terms of work at NOAA. But I'm fortunate to be able to work now on the most advanced weather satellite program that we have today in the entire world, basically.
Do you ever get to go watch the launch of these satellites?
Oh, absolutely. Watching the launch is always exciting. You know, when you're at the launch, it's not just a launch. You think about all the work that took place to get us to the launch. So these satellite programs, you don't start like yesterday or like a year ago or 2 years ago. They take a long time in planning. So we planned this mission back in the late 1990s. Sometimes it takes a good 15, 20 years of planning to make sure we get the user requirements right. We make sure we have the technology and we bring it all together, and it takes a long time. Because we're trying to develop the most advanced technology that will have staying power for the next 20 years. And that's a trick, you know, to do that. It's very important that we develop the technology, make it robust, and make sure it's long-lasting. And with JPSS, we've done that.
Well, on that note, Mitch Goldberg, Program Scientist for the Joint Polar Satellite System, or JPSS, thanks for your time. I really enjoyed talking about weather satellites with you. Next up, let's listen to a three-way discussion between Joe Pica, Rob Elvington, and myself. Joe is the Director of Observations for the National Weather Service and joins us via Skype from the NWS headquarters in Silver Springs, Maryland. Rob is a meteorologist for KRCR, the ABC affiliate in Redding, California, and he joined us from home also via Skype. And I'm your friendly radio host and self-confessed weather nerd. Joe Pica and Rob Elvington, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're joined by good friend Rob Elvington, who's a meteorologist for Channel 7R in Redding.
Thanks for having me here. A pleasure to be a part of this discussion.
Well, I'd like to start out, Joe, asking you a question. I saw that you were the captain of a couple of NOAA sea vessels that were scientific vessels. Could you just briefly tell us about what that part of your career was like?
So prior to working for the National Weather Service, I was a NOAA Corps commissioned officer. What that entailed is I came into service with an engineering degree, and I volunteered to go to sea on oceanographic and deep sea research vessels. And it was a great career. I did it for 23 years. And it was about working at sea on multiple vessels, you know, gathering data, observations about our planet, hence why I'm working Weather Service observations at this time. But my most significant jobs were commanding officer, the first commanding officer of the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer, and that was a deep sea exploration vessel. It still works today, that launches remote operating vehicles to the bottom of the ocean and takes imagery and then sends that back. But we're doing a lot of really good exploration of the oceans with that vessel. And then the flagship of the fleet, the NOAA ship Ronald H. Brown, named after a former Secretary of Commerce, that was my last command, and that's a tremendous ship, a global class ship that collects data in the oceans, and they do transects where we're measuring the what's going on with the ocean and the ocean currents, and they try and sample these transects across all the oceans every 10 years. So they just did one in the Indian Ocean. But while I was on board, we were able to do that the equator down to the Antarctic ice shelf, sampling the water from the surface all the way to the bottom every 30 miles, all the way from the equator to Antarctica. And it's a fascinating trip. Got to see a lot of the world, and it's a lot of challenges with that, you know, running a ship all across the world, but it really laid the groundwork for me from a leadership management perspective for me to be ready for the kind of job I have today with Weather Service observations.
So I'm curious as to how that maybe has informed and prepared you for your current work.
So one of the missions of my last ship was to restore the Tau array, the array that monitors El Nino, La Nina in the equatorial Pacific. And my ship actually restored that array to full functionality of better than 80% data availability. I today in the Weather Service, I'm responsible for resourcing and maintaining that particular array that my ship, and we still get ship time from the NOAA Corps, Marine and Aviation Operations, to maintain that. So one of the observations that I'm responsible for in my portfolio is marine observations, those buoy observations. I'm also responsible for radar, for surface observations at airports, weather balloons, and then interacting with our satellite partners to make sure that the data gathered from satellites meets all the requirements that our forecasters and our modelers need.
And I was going to jump in real quick to talk about that Tau Triton array. It's very important because those buoys, not only are they measuring the surface, but they go well below the surface. So they're measuring the subsurface conditions in the main ENSO region. So that's a huge deal. You may have heard just in the past week that we had an El Nino watch issued. The waters are starting to warm in the ENSO region, but we also have warm waters below the surface, and that's why those buoys that he was helping to restore are so important, that we can make these long-term ENSO forecasts.
And I'd like you two to discuss, Joe and Rob, how the, because we're talking about the NOAA 20, the polar orbiting satellites, how do they improve our weather forecasts, and what role do they play in the forecasts that, for example, that you develop, Rob? Could you guys discuss that?
I'm an operational forecaster, so every day I'm looking at the numerical weather forecast models. So the observations are very important. If you're not getting representative observations, they're not getting initialized into the models properly, it doesn't matter how high res the models are, how good they are, it all comes down to how good the observations are. So that's why these polar satellites are so important. You're getting these atmospheric soundings, so they're measuring the atmosphere. You're getting all these observations from the stratosphere all the way down to the surface. So it's very important that these obs are picked up by these polar orbiting satellites.
Rob, thanks for starting that off. You know, it's absolutely critical that you as a core partner are able to utilize this data and the products that we have to really convey to the public, you know, what's coming, what they need to do to be prepared. And so, you know, stepping back a little bit, I look at it from a, you know, the whole portfolio and what we're trying to do for weather forecasting to protect lives and property, not just Weather Service, but the whole enterprise and all of our partners. And we rely upon satellite data for a tremendous amount. The most visible is the geostationary, where you're getting images all the time, and it's kind of maintaining your situational awareness. But the polar, they are really critical for that, you know, 3 to 7 day forecast, looking out and knowing in advance what's going to be coming. And there's some blending between the two, but, you know, 85% of the data that goes into our global weather models comes from the polar satellites. And so NOAA 20 is critical for feeding that data in, you know, temperature, moisture profiles of the entire globe, every day that feed those global models so that we know what are the weather patterns, what's going to be happening several days in advance. And I'll give a couple of examples. One is tropical cyclones. I know, Rob, you went to North Carolina State, and so I'm sure you had some interest in tropical meteorology.
Oh, definitely.
But Irma last year, we were able to provide a reliable forecast several days in advance so that the governor of Florida issued a state of emergency on Monday for a storm that didn't make landfall until Saturday. That's the kind of reliance and criticality we have on the polar satellites to help those forecasts. Another one would be, the weather patterns and the trying to highlight where we're going to have severe weather or even fire potential, particularly out west. The polars shape those models so that we can actually identify areas to be watching out for in the several days in advance, so that folks can be monitoring on the ground those areas. And it's easier to handle a fire when it starts and it's small versus after it's gotten much bigger and you're in a completely reactive mode.
I'd like to chime in just real quick and mention that I'm a Weather Ready Nation ambassador for the National Weather Service. So I feel like I'm part of the team. And I'd like to ask you both, especially, Rob, maybe you could kick it off. People have some misconceptions about how accurate weather forecasts are, because my impression is from watching and keeping close tabs on what's going on. For example, just this weekend, right around the solstice, we're in a very extreme heat situation here in Northern California, and we get warnings about that. The 3 to 7 day models, and Joe, you talked about being able to action on that. They're extremely accurate now, aren't they, Rob?
They're very accurate. I tell you what, just in the last 10 years, you can see the improvements. It's amazing. And, we don't just look at one single forecast model. We look at dozens of models, the big operational medium range models, the GFS that's run through INSEP, and that's the American model. But we also have the ECMWF, and all of these operational models also have what's called ensemble models. So you can use the operational deterministic model, but also these ensembles, and you can really get a pretty good accurate forecast 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 days out. Of course, there's limitations sometimes, but with these forecast models, there's been huge improvements. You could use the National Hurricane Center, for example. If you go back to some of their forecasts, they do they do verification scores for their forecast every season, and their verification scores have improved drastically even since the 1990s. So it's really amazing to see.
I'm curious about when we look at those 3 to 7 day models, what are some of the things that you look at, Rob, as a meteorologist, and Joe, from your standpoint, in terms of extreme weather events? Because those are the ones that really catch our attention, whether they be a heat wave or fire weather or a hurricane in the Gulf or the East Coast. Tell us about how important these polar satellites are in terms of extreme weather events.
Usually I would go from big to small. So you go from subnoptic to lower scale. So when you're looking at these long range forecasts, you can kind of see these subnoptic setups, these big ridges of high pressure building in. And the forecast models, they can usually sniff that out quite a bit in advance. And of course, a lot of these systems here on the West Coast, they're moving in from offshore, from over the Pacific Ocean. So you've got these soundings and other observations from these polar orbiting satellites that is fed into the NWP. As Joe mentioned, about 85% of the observations for our weather models is from those polar orbiting satellites. You can't just release some weather balloons out in the ocean and expect that to get it done. You need these polar orbiting satellites to feed all that data into the weather models.
I'll just add, our core partners, such as emergency managers, really rely on that advanced notice that these models provide 3 to 4 days out to pre-stage equipment, gear, to have folks on the lookout for where fires would start. You know, we didn't used to have that capability. It was much more of a reaction, and now that community is more prepared and taking steps in advance of these extreme weather events. So I think that that's really a positive step forward towards a weather-ready nation, that we're trying to get folks out ready. Even the Weather Service will prepare folks to do additional staffing. We'll beef up our staffing when we know that there's going to be an event. So we're using our own forecast to properly staff locations or co-locate someone with an emergency management center, emergency operations center, or even send out incident meteorologists to a fire team. We're doing that in advance in preparation for certain events.
Joe, can you speak to the imaging capabilities of these new satellites? Because I understand you can just get these amazing high-resolution images now. What are some of the uses for those?
So I think most people are familiar with the geostationary imagery, but that's at 22,000 miles above the Earth, where the polar imagery is only at roughly 500 miles above the Earth, so you can get a much higher resolution capability. Not as often updated, but really good resolution. And we're using it in several different ways. One of those is to track fires at night. We can actually get a good snapshot of what the fire extent is. So that's one way that we use it. We're also using it over Alaska. Alaska is such a high latitude that you can't really get a good picture due to the oblique nature of the globe. So we actually use that imagery over Alaska and the Arctic to provide situational awareness for our forecasters, what's happening with the weather up there. And then finally, one of the uses for emergency response after an event is to basically look at what lights are out, to basically see nighttime lights. So for Hurricane Maria, it went over over Puerto Rico last year, and all the lights were on prior, and then afterwards, a considerable amount of the lights were out. And that's provided to the Federal Emergency Management Agency in order for them to start addressing those outages and get that power restored. So it's used after the fact as a emergency management response tool.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our conversation with Joe Pica from the National Weather Service and television meteorologist Rob Elvington from Redding, California. Stay with us. We're back. And hey, thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation with National Weather Service Director of Observations Joe Pica and television meteorologist Rob Elvington. We talked to Mitch Goldberg about, you know, some of the instrumentation on the satellites. I'm curious about which ones are the most useful for forecasters.
The microwave sounder and the infrared sounder are those key instruments that take the global measurements of temperature and humidity across the globe. And that's that 85% that gets into the global weather models. So that's really key for those forecasts out 3 to 7 days. The VIRS, the imager, is really more about the daily updates of fire extent, light outages, even flooding. You can actually see flooding extent with that instrument. That's more real-time assessment of what is occurring. And that's actually used in complement with our geostationary. The problem with that imagery is you can't see through clouds. So you actually have to, we kind of blend it with the geostationary. The geostationary picks up when there's no clouds, fills in the gaps, and then you get the best image you can when the polar goes over. So we're actually using that to do integrated flood mapping as to what's occurring after events.
So Rob, can you add to that? What did the instrumentation mean for you as a forecaster on television?
I was going to say, I often use the MODIS satellite, which is through the Terra Aqua polar orbiting satellites. And I'll often show that on air to show new fire starts. And that also has the same capability of picking up those fire detection maps. So those are very important that we have used, especially on a day like today. This is the 10-year anniversary of the 2008 lightning fires. So that mapping is important so that we can get those firefighters out there to really start tackling those fires. So that's one of the bigger things. And you'll often see on air, I'll show those MODIS imagery.
Okay, so Joe, I'd like to ask you about, you know, we think about when those of us who do think about weather satellites, we just think about them in terms of forecasting for our local forecasts and things like that. But they also have benefits throughout our society. Could you address some of those things for other government agencies and even industry?
Yeah. So, you know, the data that we collect from these, I know is primarily physical meteorology type data that we use to make forecasts. But it also is very fundamental to a lot of other things. I'll use one that has to do with water quality. So we actually, find out, from the visible imagery of that VIRS instrument that goes on the polar, that you can see what kind of chlorophyll or other things are happening in the water. We use it to basically examine algal blooms and their extent in the Great Lakes and other places along the coast. I mean, these are things that would affect, local health, your tourism industry, those kind of things. When we do when we look at these things, it actually has that kind of impact. There's also an ozone mapping, suite that's also on it that basically is looking at the health of the planet, the health of the ozone layer for protecting us and protecting our part of the planet. These kind of things, we're tracking just the heat balance of what's happening from the sun, what is the energy that's coming from the sun. So many different ways that we're using this instrument for other scientific purposes and benefits to society.
And Joe, I would assume that ozone mapping goes into those daily UV index forecasts that you'll often see in a local forecast as well.
It does.
Yeah. So, often I'll show the UV index is an 11 for tomorrow, which is in the extreme range. And of course, the ozone is one of the bigger things that protects us from that UV radiation. So that's one of these important things that the satellites are picking up.
You know, just adding on to that a little bit, when you have fires and you have smoke plumes or you have volcanic ash plumes from eruptions, it's really key to track those and be able to show where they're going to go. And that affects the aviation industry. We want folks to be able to travel safely and we route them around that. We don't route them, but we provide the information to the FAA so they can route them safely. And so that's another area that isn't, strictly weather, but that basically benefits society.
You know, I noticed that the satellite we've been talking about, JPSS, the polar satellite, JPSS-1. That was launched in November. How quickly did you get that into an observational mode where it could start aiding forecasters like Rob?
We actually got it into operations faster than any other satellite we have in history. So that we had the benefit of a SUMI MPP, basically a demonstration satellite that NASA launched in 2011, that was a precursor to this. But basically, we were getting this data into our model feeds by the end of February after launching in November. So it went through its checkout. And we got it into our models for doing its tests. We always make sure that it runs offline so there's a do no harm to our models. We want to make sure that there's no degradation and that we are making improvements with the addition of the data. We were able to validate that in the middle of May, and by May 30th, we went operational with that satellite. And again, that's the fastest we've done that in our history with these types of satellites. And we continue to try and accelerate that to make maximum use of the satellites we put into space, because we put a lot of investment into those.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I believe with, what was it, the geostationary GOES 16 satellite, it took about 10 months or so for it to become operational, or maybe even longer than that. So it kind of gives you an idea how fast that was for that polar orbiting satellite.
We took a lot longer with the geostationary, as it it had a greater variety of instruments. But I will say that the advanced baseline imager for GOES 16, that we had it in a test mode available to forecasters to use relatively quickly, because it had launched the previous November, and by the March timeframe, we were starting to see data. It wasn't fully operational, but folks were actually using it. And the first thing we found out when we started to use it is we detected fires on the ground in the Midwest prior to 911 calls going to the responding agencies. So it was pretty impressive. So earlier, Rob mentioned the Eureka fire of 2008 in Northwest California, caused by a lot of lightning strikes. The geostationary satellite that we now have, we've got GOES-R up and operating over the east. We're going through the checkout now for GOES-17, but they have increased capabilities for updates as well as resolution, and that's what they saw the fire with that in the channels. But they also bring a new feature, and it's called a geostationary lightning mapper. And this is the first time we've had an operational lightning mapper from space. What's really important about that is over time, we've just been measuring lightning from the ground, from ground stations. Now we have the ability to do it from space, and we're putting that into operations. And the key there, in particular for Northwest California, is the lightning mapper from space can see it over the ocean. And so it can see it in advance for weather patterns coming towards us, or in the Gulf of Mexico, same kind of thing. And then we can get a sense of intensity for things that we can't even see from the ground. So really, we're really excited about the geostationary lightning mapper and the potential it has to really improve our capabilities.
And I would add to that, why it's so important with these satellites. Often here in the warm season, we get what's called elevated convection. So it's not surface-based. So when you get these systems that come through in June, July, and August, they're sometimes difficult to forecast because you're not relying on that daytime heating. It's convection that can fire in the middle of the night. And that's what happened with the 2008 lightning fires. So with this increased resolution, better observations, that really helps to improve these forecasts. Some of those fires from 2008, they went 24 hours or longer without any staffing from firefighters because we just did not have the staffing in place. There was dozens of new fire starts in 2008. So being able to really hone in on that 24, 36, 48 hours in advance, that gives us enough lead time to start staffing with the firefighters.
I'll just mention in addition, Rob, that the polar satellite, we didn't have an imager up there until 2011 on the SUMI NPP, you know, the precursor to JPSS-1, that now we're mapping those daily, what the extent of those fires are, so that we would have seen that much sooner than we did back in 2008.
Wow. And so that, you know, as we go into this next fire season, and of course in California last year was just catastrophic, it goes to show how important these instruments in space are for our lives on Earth.
Absolutely. At the launch out in Vandenberg for JPSS-1, you know, we had a representative on the panel there from CAL FIRE. That's how important that instrument is to that group, that they wanted to be there to see it because they realized how important it is to the jobs that they do.
Well, Joe, I really appreciate you spending some time with us today and your work on the entire fleet of NOAA satellites and your work with NOAA in the past on those ships. I really appreciate you joining us. It was really interesting.
Thank you very much, Dave. Pleasure talking to you and talking to you as well, Rob.
Thank you so much, Joe and Dave.
Thanks once again to our guests, Mitch Goldberg, the Chief Project Scientist for NOAA's Joint Polar Satellite System, and Joe Pica, Director of Observations for the National Weather Service, and our good friend Rob Elvington, Meteorologist for KRCR Channel 7 in Redding, California. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Share this episode with your friends or check out our archive at mynspr.org. Better yet, subscribe to Blue Dot via NPR Podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.